Okay, I think I'm getting technology all set here. It's great to see you, brethren. And that was a wonderful song about the Sabbath, a good lead-in, as you'll find out, into the message today. But I wanted to say that a while back we had an in-home Bible study, and we covered the fifth chapter of the book of John, in the Gospel of John. And in that chapter is recorded, it's recorded that an unnamed feast occurred in Jerusalem, and around that time, Jesus Christ healed a lame man on the Sabbath day, and he defended that action of healing that man to the Pharisees in a great discourse, a great teaching that he gave. And the theme of that teaching after the healing was the importance for us to have judgment, mercy, and faith. As was written in a recent letter by the chairman of the Council of Elders, Dr. Don Ward, he emphasized and brought out the point of how important those qualities are. There is much we can learn about God, both God the Father and Jesus Christ, by studying John chapter 5. So, brethren, let's see. Whenever we crank the light on. So that's what, brethren, I would like to talk to you about today is the lessons from the Pool of Bethesda miracle that we can glean to understand more about God. And that's John chapter 5, which is verses 1 through 47. So, the purpose of the message is to consider the profound insights about God found in that chapter. So, but before we get to the core of the message, I'd like to just give, if I may, some background, which I found extremely interesting and helps us to understand the whole context of what Christ did and taught better. So let's ask the question, when did that occur, that event, that miraculous healing occur, and where did it occur? So if we can go to John chapter 5 and start with the very first verse, John chapter 5, verse 1, it says, proceeding after chapter 4, and I think the encounter with Nicodemus and other things, the woman at the well and things of that nature, actually the woman at the well. It says, after this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. So that's all it says about this feast. So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, I looked at many commentaries, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's commentary said, what feast? And then they said, no question has more divided the harmonists of the Gospels. This is a big controversy among scholars and those who do create harmony of the Gospel. There's a whole appendix in the Harmony of the Gospels by A.T. Robertson trying to answer that question. And if you go on the internet, every possibility you could think of the feast, both the feasts in Leviticus 23, Purim, Hanukkah, you name it. There's many, many, many different ideas about what feast it was. I would say that the general consensus among the Church of God is that this is dealing with a fall festival, one of the feasts during the fall festival. Now, I'd like to quote from Mr. Fred Coulter, in his 1974 edition of The Harmony of the Gospels he did, just a few things. He's talking about John 5, and he says, First of all, he says, looking at this in context, the topics are the resurrections and the judgments. So that's one thing that you'll see in this chapter. And this festival season, well, he felt very strongly and said, could only be, and I would say that it looks so, there's great arguments to believe that it was this. The fall festival season, because those are called the judgment feasts. The feasts, which are the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, the Feast of Tabernacles, the Last Great Day, the Eighth Day. All of these feasts are known as judgment feasts. And we'll see that as we read the book of John. Another is the contextual verification of this pattern of John's writings. Dr. Ward and Mr. Bradford, I believe, mentioned that to really understand any part of the Bible, you have to understand the entire Bible. And the fact that we keep the holy days opens up a key for us to understand things in a way that if we didn't keep them, we would not understand. And so the fact that we know about the annual holy days and how they describe God's plan of salvation helps us. So even in understanding the book of John, the pattern is there in the book of John. Chapters 2 and 3 record a Passover. Chapter 4 is an allusion to Pentecost. Chapter 5 shows the fall festival season. As I'm saying to you now, that I believe that that is the best understanding, that this is a fall festival season, probably the Feast of Trumpets, which is just coming up for us to observe. Chapter 6 is the Passover. 7 7 through 10, 21 is the Feast of Tabernacles and the Last Great Day, or as we're saying, the Eighth Day. The last part of chapter 10 records events surrounding the Feast of Dedication in the winter, which, of course, is not one of the annual holy days mentioned in Leviticus 23, but it was a national observance of the Jews, a commemoration that they had. And then the rest of the book of John is devoted to the final Passover and the resurrection and the events occurring directly afterwards. So following this pattern, as Mr. Coulter said, we see that John wrote in this following sequence: Passover, fall festival season, Passover, fall festival season, Passover. These are some of the internal evidences which indicate that the feast mentioned, the unnamed feast mentioned in John 5, probably was a fall festival. Probably the Feast of Trumpets. So let's go now. So that was the when. Now the where. And this is extremely interesting. If we go to verse 2 of John 5. So it says in verse 2 of John 5, it says, Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. So the first thing I wanted to note is it's by the sheep gate. Keep that in mind. And the name of the pool is Bethesda. And that particular pool had five porches, or porticos, some translations say, or colonnaded walkways, columned walkways. Now, this I got from readingfacts.com, an interesting statement from that website. It says, the pool is near the sheep gate, and I'm going to show you a photo, actually, to get the geographical setting of things. On the north end of the temple, the gate is mentioned in Nehemiah and may have been used for sheep being brought to the temple for sacrifice. The pool would therefore be used to wash the sheep before they were brought into the temple for sacrifice. This means that the pool was not the sort of place where, and he used the word classy people, I would say the lower class, the lower echelon, not the upper crust, not the movers and shakers of their society, but those of the lower class of society went, and the poorer went to wash before entering the temple. The fact that a number of invalids are waiting for the water to stir to be healed means that the pool was a gathering, and I don't like the word lower class. I would just say people poorer and the outcasts, those who this world has left behind, you might say, the sick and the injured. Okay, so then this is quite interesting. So think of that, and then think of this. The site was also likely the location of a shrine, a Roman shrine dedicated to Asclepius, the Greek and Roman god of healing. This is certainly the site of Hadrian's shrine of Asclepius and Serapis, and it appears that a pool dedicated to these gods was first built in the first century BC. I'm giving you pieces of the puzzle, and it might sound disconnected, but keep these thoughts in mind. James Charlesworth, and I had the blessing of actually meeting him when he came to San Francisco for a session of the Biblical Archaeology Review. It was the same weekend as our anniversary of the church, of the 50-year anniversary. So all I got to go for that whole weekend was a Friday afternoon presentation, and was by him. And afterwards, I went up and said how much I appreciated him coming. He's one of the noted scholars of our time, biblical scholars. Dr. James Charlesworth thinks that there was, if the five porticos describes the unusual building housing the pools, then it is possible that one area was dedicated to Asclepius, and another was used to wash sacrificial animals. So keep that. I know it sounds like a contradiction and a puzzle. So, I forgot to do the underlining, but I think I emphasized it here. That they probably... Okay, so now that was mentioning about the pool. But what does the Hebrew word Bethesda mean? Well, the main... meaning that is brought up over and over again is house of mercy. Bethesda, house of mercy. Strong's Concordance calls it the house of kindness. And Lang's commentary says it can translate as house of kindness, grace, gentleness, or house of mercy. A very appropriate place for what Christ was to do there. Now, Mr. Mario Segli, in an April 2000 Good News Magazine article, mentions, and this is very interesting, for years, critics questioned John's description of a pool having five porches, because such an architectural design, and when most of the people who read that say, Pentagon, they didn't build... There's no archaeological evidence that people built pentagon-shaped pools at that time. It must be an error. John was wrong. There's a lot of Bible scholars like that. They really don't believe that the Bible is inspired. And there was no knowledge of where that the location of that pool had been lost for many, many centuries. In fact, I'll show you, it was actually until the late 1800s. Now, as I said here, so because such an architectural design, in other words, a pentagon shape, would be highly unusual, but that changed when excavators began digging in the area about a century ago. When Bethesda was cleared, quoting from the article, of the rubble of centuries and brought once more to light, to the light of day, those archaeologists discovered a vast double pool covering 5,000 square yards to the north of the temple area. It, in fact, had five colonnades. These are walkways with columns on the walkways, on the sides of the walkways. Four of these surrounded the whole place, but the fifth porch or portico, in which the sick folk mostly lay, waiting to be healed, stood on a ridge of rock which divided the two pools. That was from The Bible as History by Werner Keller. The fifth porch, this is continuing Mr. Segley's article, which had led some to question or even dismiss John's account, was this columned walkway separating the two pools. John's description was proven accurate. It's amazing what percentage of the biblical scholars are skeptics who don't really believe that the Bible is inspired. And I think, as we've said in the past, they probably should be plowing corn instead of doing their job. But anyway, Mr. John McCrae, an archaeologist and professor of the New Testament, in his book is an incredible book, which I learned of by reading from Mr. Segley of that book. And it is a very well done archaeological book on the New Testament. Adds that in the excavations, quote, many fragments of columned bases, capitals and drums, or column sections, were found, which probably belonged to the five porches, or porticos, or colonnaded walkways, of the pool John mentions. That's Archaeology in the New Testament by Mr. McCrae. So, brethren, I don't know if you can see this, but you can undoubtedly see the Dome of the Rock. This area, this big area, is the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And, of course, the first and the second temples were right in that general area, right around where the Dome of the Rock is, or slightly to the north. It's debated, but it's in that area. Bethesda, the Pool of Bethesda, is north-north. East. That purple circle right here that I'm putting the cursor at, north of the Temple Mount, that's where the Pool of Bethesda was found to be in about 1888, actually. So here's remnants of it as is now, and it's a complex area, archaeological site. The Bethesda Pool, where Jesus heals the paralytic man in the Gospel of John, is a complex site. It appears to have been a mikvah, that's what some believe, or ritual bath. Okay, so I'll put all this all together, but it sounds like I'm contradicting here. As the spot of one of Jesus' miracles, the Bethesda Pool was built over in subsequent periods with chapels and churches that are still visible today. And this is just another modern photo of the archaeological site. Now, this is an artist's reconstruction of how the Pool of Bethesda looked in the time of Christ. So, picture that you're in the north. You're looking from the north, and you're looking, and there's the temple. So, you're looking south, southwest. And in front of you is the Pool of Bethesda. And it is actually two pools connected together to make one complex. So, when they said that there were five porches or porticos, they were talking about the fact that there was a southern portico, a western portico, a northern portico, an eastern portico, and a middle portico. So the Bible was vindicated. So it was about actually 1888 when they were doing some repair work of the Church of St. Anne, and stumbled across this, this archaeological site. Now, Josephus mentions about the Pool of Bethesda, and Eusebius, one of the early fathers, as they, I think they call him, he wrote about it. And interesting thing is, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, there is a scroll which is actually made of copper. The copper scroll text was discovered in Qumran, 1947, and it said there was a hidden treasure there. Now, I have not heard of anyone finding a treasure there, but it said that there's a treasure buried under or around the Pool of Bethesda. So I'll go back. So the upper pool here may have been the pool where the sheep were. May have been the pool actually to the pagan. The pagan god of medicine. The lower pool may have been near the sheep gate where sheep were bathed and I don't want to get ahead of myself. Where the central focus of this of the book of John 5 is discussing. So let's go on that. But anyway, the interesting thing about that copper scroll that was found in Qumran is that it describes that it uses a word, eshdayatayin, an Aramaic word suggesting two basins. So the word used in the Dead Sea Scroll actually suggested that this pool actually had two basins, or it was a pool made of two pools, confirming what the archaeologists found. So in this in the International Christian Assembly of Jerusalem website, this is quite interesting. It says, for hundreds of years, people believing the pool did not exist read this text symbolically and theologically. Now, there's nothing wrong with reading the scriptures for symbolism. There is much symbolism in the Bible. Absolutely no question about it. But some people spiritualize things away, and they don't take things literal at all, in many cases when they should. So they said, well, there really wasn't a pool, but this is representing, was interpreted to be a symbol only to show Christ's mercy. And since it had not been found, a pentagon-shaped pool in antiquity, and what the Pentateuch could not do, they said, this was showing that Jesus will do. And they said, Jesus said to this man, as we'll see, stand up. And he's talking to Christians about standing up and makes people stand up uprightly and things like that. Well, there is symbolism in the Bible, but that's not only what this is. This is describing a real event that happened at a real pool in the city of Jerusalem. So it had a smaller basin, as I said. Now, okay. Now to verse 3. Now we'll get into actually the sermon. But I thought this was really interesting background, and it adds meaning to what we see. Verse 3 of John 5 says, In these porticos, especially probably the middle one, lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. Now, you notice I colored the first part yellow and the next part blue, light blue. Okay, there's a method to my madness. It says, in these lay a great multitude of sick people or impotent people, unable to do anything for themselves. These people were helpless. They were blind. They were lame or halt. There were people with withered or paralyzed in some translations. Various terrible afflictions for these people. And we have no reason to believe that there were not, that not to believe that there were people like that at this pool. Now, the scholars have studied this, and they studied, and what they call in their study of John 5:3 and John 5:4, when they picked this apart and analyzed this, they called the first part that I have yellow John 5:3a, the first phrase, and the second part they call it John 5:3b, the second phase of verse 3 of our New King James and our King James Bible and other Bibles. So many translations do not have what I have colored in blue. Many, many translations do not. In the Revised Version, for instance, it says, "In these lay a multitude of them that were sick, blind, halt, withered." Period. It does not mention waiting to be for the moving of the water. Okay, here we go. Okay, now John, verse 4. Now I have this all in blue. In verse 4. "For an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had." That's in the King James, the New King James, and some translations. But there are many translations that do not have this verse at all. Now, I saw an article by this Mr. Gordon D. Fee, F-E-E, on the internet. And he did, a scholarly dissertation on the authenticity of John 5, 3b and 4. This article is on the internet. I'll just give you a few excerpts of what he said. "The New Testament scholarship, by and large, has regarded the reference to the angel stirring of the waters of Bethesda," John 5, 3b and 4, "to be a gloss and therefore no part of the original text of the fourth gospel." In other words, there were manuscripts where people wrote helps. So it's like our inspired margins, you know. They wrote helps to help people understand things. And this, there are ancient manuscripts that do have John 3b and John 4. John 5, 3b and John 5, 4. All right, let me get it back here. I will just skip some of that and go right to this. Now, I know this is Greek. This is Greek to me, and it's probably Greek to you. But what this Mr. Fee had done is he took all on the left side are what different translators decided to do, and there's five different options. Every permutation has been represented. And the notes on the back, every one of these is an ancient manuscript. Every one of these are ancient manuscripts that have been found that cover that area of John 5. Some of these ancient manuscripts, which were used by the King James translators, include both John 3b and John 5 3b and 4, verse 4. Some include it with asterisks. In other words, they put it on the side. They do the gloss or commentary option. Some include only verse 4 and they don't do 5:3b, and some do 5:3b but not 4. And many omit 5:3b and 4. And there is, of course, no possible way that this material could have been added or omitted by accident. It was either intentionally expunged, gotten rid of, removed from their texts, or intentionally inserted. Furthermore, We are not dealing with a single addition or deletion. The data demand a process or independent additions or deletions of more than one kind, because there were many manuscripts that did the same thing. So it wasn't just one scribe doing this and coming up with this one way or the other. His analysis, Mr. Fee's analysis, says that these manuscripts, he believes, are more authoritative manuscripts, and they are spread out over a greater geographical dispersion of the Middle East in various places remote from each other, and the quality of the translations he feels are of higher quality. The ones that do not have John 5, 3b, and 4. So this is what Mr. Fee concludes. We may rightly conclude that the confidence with which New Testament scholarship has almost unanimously rejected both 5.3b and 5.4 is well-founded. And then I'll drop down. Given the love of angels found everywhere in early Christian piety, it is easy to account for the addition of the prevailing superstition about the pool to texts of the Gospel of John. And then he said, there is no known historical reason that John 5, 3b, and 4 should be true. It goes way against the Levitical cleansing rituals. There was no mention in the Bible of angels. The only mention in the Bible is that God himself heals. There's no mention in the true scriptures of God delegating that to angels to heal. Since the passage is so thoroughly non-Johannine, that means it wasn't the style that the Apostle John used. In fact, in this article by Mr. Fee, he said the way that John 3b and 5.3b and 4, the style is totally different from the entire rest of the book of John. It would be, he said, this is what he said, I'm just paraphrasing it. It would be like a man, a Bostonian, a man who grew up in Boston, writing and saying, you all come down and have dinner with us sometime, you all. He said it's that, to him, that much of a contrast in the style of 3b and 4 to the rest of the book of John. So anyway, that's his dramatic way of saying it just doesn't match John's style. So the addition of the prevailing superstition about the pool to text of the Gospel of John, that's what he was saying. So it said, now this is interesting. John, I should have put 5.3b and 4, was evidently added by scribes, first by side notes and manuscripts, and then into the text to explain, when we get to verse 7. It was undoubtedly done to try to explain to people what you will read in verse 7 of John 5. Using prevailing pagan customs and to please later years' proclivity to look to angels. So we know that there's a lot in modern Christendom that looks to angels a lot, sometimes more than to God. So, let's see here. Okay, now he said, okay, I've given you a scholarly analysis, just a non-emotional scholarly evaluation why I don't think John 5, 3b and 4 was truly part of the scriptures, was truly part of the inspired scriptures, and why it's omitted in so many of the modern translations. But then he said, I want to give you a theological postscript, something after my treatise here. And he said, and I'm just going to read this to you so we can think about this. The idea of an angel giving healing properties to water has all the earmarks of ancient superstition rather than a New Testament view of the miraculous. On the other hand, the view of God presented in this particular superstition seems to stand over against a biblical view of God. There is a kind of capriciousness to grace that allows only one person to be healed and only the first one into the pool at that. One wonders how this can be grace that loads all the advantages toward the one who is the least sick. In other words, the fastest, the one who can move the fastest, and thus most able to jump into the pool, while month after month, year after year, those who need it most must lose hope of ever being made whole. One can gladly affirm that such an account is no part of the inspired original. That is not the God. God would not do something like that to people. That would be sadistic. The NIV, notice if you have an NIV translation, it has John 3, and then it has John 5. It has John 3a, and then John 5. No 3b or 4. So, now, brethren, if we can go to, with that in mind, if we can now go to John 5, verses 6 through 15. And I want to just grab some notes I have here. Okay, so notice the first thing in verse, now that we're going to verse 5. Now this is interesting. It says, John 5:5, it says, "Now a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years." And then it says, "When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been in that condition a long time, he said to him, 'Do you want to be made well?'" The man didn't know who Christ was, and the man didn't even ask him to be healed. The man was just there after 38 years of suffering like that. And then in verse 7, it says, "The sick man answered him, 'Sir, I have no man.'" This is the verse 7. This is the verse that those people tried to help us understand by adding spurious words to the Bible. "The sick man answered him, 'Sir, I have no man when the water is troubled to put me into the pool. But while I am coming, another steps down before me.'" Now, I want to read just a very short excerpt from Mr. Alfred Edersheim on this, just a very short thing, commenting on this. So, this is so eloquent. "On the one side, a multitude whose sufferings and false expectancies rose like the wail of the starving for bread. And on the other side, the neighboring temple, down south of this, with its priesthood and teachers who in their self-seeking and the trifling of their religious externalism," in other words, the religion was not in their heart, "neither understood, heard, nor would have cared for such a cry." They wouldn't have cared for those people at that pool. They didn't care about the suffering of those people. And that is very evident in the next few verses we read. They're dropping down. This is in the life and times of Jesus the Messiah, by the way. "There was twofold suffering there, and it were difficult to know which would have stirred him most, that of the body or of the mistaken earnestness which so trustfully looked for heaven's relief, yet within such narrow limits as the accident or good fortune of being first pushed into the angel-troubled waters." Which was worse, their suffering or their delusion? Their delusion of hope, of false hope. And then another on the next page, he says, it is indeed impossible to think of incarnate deity, in other words, God in the flesh. And this, be it remembered, is the fundamental postulate of the Gospels. That is the fundamental teaching that Jesus Christ was God in the flesh. As brought into contact with misery, disease, and death, without that suffering being removed, how could God in the flesh, God, the God who is love, of mercy, and this was Bethesda, the pool of mercy, the house of mercy, it's impossible to think that he couldn't be moved to want to heal the suffering that he saw. That power went forth from him always, everywhere, and to all, is absolutely necessary if he was the Son of God, the Savior of the world. And so the miracles, as we mistakenly term, the result of the contact of God with man, of the Emmanuel, the God with us, are not only the golden ladder which leads up to the miracle, in other words, for humans to reach to God, God manifest in the flesh, but the steps by which he descends from his height to our lowliness. That is the symbolism, the true symbolism of verses 5 and 6 and 7. And now in verse 8, going to verse 8, Jesus saith to him, arise, take up your bed and walk. Now, it wasn't a California king, by the way. In verse 9, and straightway the man was made whole and took up his bed and walked. By the way, now it was the Sabbath on that day. Now, Christ deliberately chose to do this on the Sabbath. And then it says in verse 10, so the Jews said to him, who was cured, it is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed. So, but you know what? That's not in any of the inspired scriptures. Nowhere in the scriptures did it say, you shall not carry a bed on the Sabbath. It says, you shall keep the Sabbath holy. Even if it's a mat instead of a California king. Okay, verse 11. But he answered them, this man, he that made me whole, and he still didn't know who the man was, the same said to me, take up thy bed and walk. And you know, when a man after 38 years is healed, I think he would do what the man said. And what a miracle. After 38 years of your muscles atrophying and you know, not using your muscles, and then you just immediately get up. It was miracle compounded on miracle. Verse 12, they asked him, who is the man that said to you, take up your bed and walk? And in verse 13, but he that was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had conveyed himself away, the multitude being in the place. He disappeared after the healing. Verse 14, afterward, Jesus finds him in the temple and said to him, behold, you are made whole. And then he said, sin no more, lest a worse thing befall you. So this chapter deals with mercy, of course, and it also deals with judgment. That's just one more reason why we believe the feast was a fall festival. Verse 15, the man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him whole. So Christ revealed himself then in the temple that it was Jesus Christ himself, the Messiah, who had healed him. Then in verse 16, and for this cause did the Jews persecute Jesus, because he did these things on the Sabbath. And in verse 17, But Jesus answered them, "My Father works even until now, and I work." And then in verse 18, okay, "And now," the Jews heard it. Now, one wonders why the Jews were there instead of in the temple area. Maybe it was because there were sheep. I don't know, but there were Jews there. "For this cause, therefore, the Jews sought the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath in their eyes, but also called God, had the audacity to call God his own Father, making himself equal with God." So they realized what he was saying. They realized that he said he was God, the Son. Verse 19, "Jesus therefore answered and said to him," I'm reading from the Revised Version, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of himself, but what he sees the Father doing, for what things soever he does, these the Son also does in like manner. Christ, as it says in Philippians 2, divested himself of his power and had to totally depend on God the Father to perform the miracles, even though it was totally his will to do the will of God the Father. But he emptied himself of his great power as a physical human being, as is brought out in our booklet on Jesus Christ, the Real Story. In verse 20, "For the Father loves the Son and shows him all things that that himself doeth, and greater works than these." I'll shift over to the New King James to make it a little easier read. "For the Father loves the Son and shows him all things that he himself does, and he will show him greater works than these, that you may marvel." Christ showed great works, even more works after this, during his ministry. Verse 21. "For as the Father raises the dead and gives him life, and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will." God the Father has given, delegated that to that judgment to Christ, and said, "Even so the Son gives life to whom he will." In verse 22, "For the Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son." A theme of the judgment feasts. Verse 23, "That all may honor the Son, even as they honor the Father. He that honors not the Son honors not the Father which sent him." And now going into verses 24 through 30, says, "Most assuredly I say to you, he who hears my word and believes in him who sent me," God the Father, "has everlasting life and shall not come into judgment, but has passed from death to life." So we have been given the down payment with the Holy Spirit of eternal life. We've been given that down payment by our baptism and our reception of the Holy Spirit. "Most assuredly, I say to you, the hour is coming and now is when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son to have life in himself, and has given him authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. And verse 30, I can, and then he repeats for emphasis, I can of myself do nothing. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is righteous, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of the Father who sent me. So now, going into verse, and by the way, is regarding verse 30, as I mentioned, that's in Jesus Christ, the real story. Jesus did not perform miracles on his own, as I said. The last part of verse 30. Nelson's Bible study Bible footnote says about his judgment, when Christ said, my judgment is righteous. Christ's judgment is righteous because it is in accordance with God the Father's divine will. Verse 31 says, If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. Now, Nelson, that same Nelson study Bible footnote, a little farther on, says, according to Jewish legal practice, a person's testimony about himself was not accepted in court. It was not acceptable for a person to be a witness for himself, defending himself, which stands, makes sense. So in this case, Jesus first offered another witness. And that the first witness we'll read about in verse 33. So it is another that bears witness of me. And I know that the witness which he witnesses of me is true. And in verse 33, you have sent unto John, and he hath borne witness to the truth. So the first witness that Christ used to say that he was who he claimed to be was John the Baptist. Verse 34. But the witness which I receive is not from man, howbeit I say these things that you may be saved. And then in verse 35, it says, he, that's referring to John the Baptist, was, past tense, the lamp that burned and shines. And you, in fact, the King James and others say light, but the New King James says lamp. And you were willing for a time to rejoice in his light. So the Greek word, suffice it to say, the Greek word that was referring to John the Baptist was a word that was a different word than when Christ said, you are the light of the world, or when he said, I am the light of the world. So to distinguish it was a lamp. John the Baptist was a lamp, and either he had already been executed or he was in prison. But he wasn't a witness at that time anymore. He wasn't able to be a witness at that time. Verse 36. But I have a greater witness than John's, for the works which the Father has given me to finish, the very works that I do bear witness of me that the Father has sent me. Again, Nelson study Bible footnote. Those were specific works that the Son was to perform as foretold in the Old Testament, such as in Isaiah 35 and other places, to attest to the fact that he was sent by the Father. And there you'll read about that he was going to heal the brokenhearted and the lame. The lame shall be healed. So the healing itself was a witness that he was the Messiah. Verse 37. 37. And the Father himself who sent me has testified of me. So now he said, not only John the Baptist, but God the Father. You have neither heard his voice at any time, nor seen his form. In verse... In verse 38, But you do not have his word abiding in you, because whom he sent, him you do not believe. Now, in the I'm going to read from the Revised Version. You see, it reads it like this. You have not his word abiding in you. It says that. For whom he sent, him you do not believe. God the Father sent me, and you don't believe. And then he said, you search the scriptures. It phrases that way. Because you think in them you have eternal life. And these scriptures are they which bear witness of me. So then the third witness he mentions is the Holy Scriptures themselves bear witness of him. And just a something to ponder, something to contemplate. He told those men that you search the scriptures daily, those Jewish leaders. And what was the favorite verse of the Jewish peoples of that time? What was the most revered verse in all the Old Testament? Does anyone have a thought? What I was thinking of is they call it the Shema, where it says in Deuteronomy 6, it says, you shall love the Eternal, or the Lord your God, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your being. That was the most revered verse in the Old Testament. And these people had memorized that and searched the scriptures and could recite great passages of the Old Testament. In fact, they were committed. The practice in the time of Christ was to memorize great portions of the Pentateuch. It was common for great sections of the scriptures to be memorized, and the book of Psalms and others. But anyway, but it's possible to study the Bible intensely and still not have God's word abiding in a person. This is a sobering thing to keep in mind about how important it is not only to study God's word, but have it become part of us and make it part of our heart, to change our heart. In other words, Christ was saying, you've got to have the judgment, mercy, and faith. You've got to have all of that. And not just technical knowledge by searching the scriptures. Verse 40. And you will not come. Let me see, I'll go to that. Okay, in verse 40. But you are not willing to come to me that you may have life. I do not receive honor from men. But I know you, that you do not have the love of God in you. And that doesn't mean that they weren't loved by God. That doesn't refer to the love from God to them. That refers to what I was just saying. They did not have love toward God. That Deuteronomy 6, Shema, love. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, him you will receive. Has that ever happened? Have people come in God's name and they were not really the true representatives of God? Have people followed people like that? Has that ever happened in history? I'll just say yes. I'll just say yes. Absolutely. It's happened. I mean, even Adolf Hitler was a false Messiah. Why did he say he was going to have the Third Reich 1,000 years? It was a false Christ. And of course, in the religious world, it's a sad commentary on religion, how people have become idols to be focused on instead of people focusing on God. People have idolized humans, and religious leaders have allowed themselves to be idolized. But Christ said that's not the way. He just said that that's not. He didn't want glory of men. He says, I do not receive glory of men from men. But I know that you do not have the love of God, as I read, I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me, as I said. If another comes in his own name, him you will receive. Sadly, that happens. How can you believe who receive honor from one another and do not seek the honor that comes from the only God? The only honor we really want is the honor when Christ says, "Well done, you good and faithful servant." That's the only honor we should ever really want. That's the ultimate honor. Do not think that I shall accuse you to the Father. He's talking to these people who are condemning him for healing a man who had been sick for 38 years. Can you think of the torment he went through? Of thinking that he could be healed. It would be a sadistic thing. It's just a terrible thing. What an attitude he may have had of God after 38 long years of wishing he could be in the pool to be healed. Do not think that I shall accuse you of the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, in whom you trust. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. Christ was the prophet that was spoken of in the Pentateuch that was to come, that was to be like unto, that Moses was to be a type of, the ultimate prophet. But if you do not believe his writings, in other words, Moses' writings, how will you believe my words? So, I know I have a conclusion here. So, try to find it here quickly. But like I said, that sort of a great reminder was Dr. Ward's recent letter about how vitally important it is to have judgment, mercy, and faith. And if we have the mercy to know that God is love, then we would rejoice that a man had been healed on the Sabbath. It wouldn't have even been a question that the God of love was willing to heal somebody on the Sabbath like that, that it would have been part of God's will. So, evidently, I can't seem to find the conclusion. So, brethren, I think that is, let us contemplate, let us glean from this greater depths of understanding about our God of love, our God of judgment, mercy, and faith, and to learn that and to glean the love that Jesus Christ had for that man who, though he suffered for 38 years, and that was definitely a terrible trial, that has been recorded for all eternity in the New Testament, that had happened, and he will rejoice someday as he is resurrected. And that 38 years, which it says was a long time, and for humans it was a short time in the scheme of God's plan. So with that, let us learn the lessons from John chapter 5.